Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Lawmakers are returning to D.C. today, and the first item on the agenda is the so-called fiscal cliff. It's a package of tax increases and spending cuts, which will take effect in January unless Congress passes a budget deal. On the taxes, we're specifically talking about the Bush tax cuts, which, according to the National Priorities Project, cost $955 billion between 2001 and 2010. And then the Obama extension cost $229 billion between 2011 and this year. And then there's Social Security and Medicare. According to documents obtained by the Washington Post's Bob Woodward last year, the White House made an offer with Republicans to reach a $4 trillion grand bargain. The Obama administration was willing to cut TRICARE, that's the health insurance program for military retirees, also to cut Social Security and Medicare. Those talks ultimately failed, but according to Woodward, the White House was willing to go far with these cuts. Liberal groups and union leaders are meeting with the president today to urge him to reject cuts on social programs. And then tomorrow, he's meeting with a number of CEOs from companies like Walmart, Honeywell, and General Electric. These are all behind closed door meetings. On Friday, he'll be meeting with top Democrats and Republicans. And in the middle of all of these meetings, he will hold his first press conference since June. So when we're talking about this so-called fiscal cliff, what are we really facing here? Are we really heading for a free fall? How should we understand these current debates, both about the taxes and the budget cuts, and who really has the power? Jeff Madrick says the fiscal cliff must be very confusing to most of us. Largely ignored during the presidential campaign, it suddenly seems to be Washington's sole focus. But know this, it is quite a problem. Jeff Madrick is a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books, and he writes the Anti-Economist column, we love that name, for Harper's Magazine. His latest book is called Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. It is now out in paperback. Hi, Jeff. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Thanks for joining us. We're also joined by Kevin Hall. Kevin is national economics reporter for McClatchy, based in Washington, D.C., and his latest piece about the fiscal cliff is called Put Up or Shut Up Time for Congress, Obama on Fiscal Cliff. Hi, Kevin. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you. So I just want to find out, Kevin, do you know who came up with this term, fiscal cliff? Because it's all we're hearing about this week.
Yeah, the term itself has been around in a lot of different contexts, probably dating back to the 50s. But in this particular context, Ben Bernanke seems to be the person who came up with it in a February testimony before Congress earlier this year in February. He referred to it in a concrete term of, you know, we're facing a fiscal cliff, and that kind of became the shorthand for all these things that are kind of coming together at the end of the year.
And Jeff, you write that this fiscal cliff must be very confusing to most of us. All of a sudden it just appeared, and now it's being used by just about everyone in the media. What are your thoughts on that? Give us a brief overview. What are they really talking about here?
Well, it wasn't talked very much about during the election. I think it was talked about quite a bit before. I mean, before the election got closed during the campaign. I think it has to be confusing to Americans. Why do we have to suddenly face this dangerous cliff that could likely or possibly lead us to recession? It involves the expiration of a bunch of tax cuts, including the George Bush tax cuts, at the end of 2012. They were always set to expire at the end of 2012, plus what is called this multi-syllable word, sequestration, that was agreed to by Congress basically as part of the Budget Control Act back in 2011, which require cutting government spending to meet certain goals about cutting the budget deficit. And both of those are coming together at the beginning of 2013, and the result is it should... If nothing is done about it, the result should be very clear to people. Taxes will go up not just on the wealthy, but on all of us, and quite significantly. And at the same time, we'll be cutting the budget, including military spending, automatically. That will be a big downer for the economy. It will withdraw stimulus. It will withdraw government debt government stimulus for the economy at a time when the economy is still fairly weak. In fact, it could withdraw as much as 3 to 4% of buying power out of the economy when the economy is very weak. And that will definitely, I would say, but certainly almost definitely, lead to a significant recession again.
And Kevin?
Yeah, I think the numbers, the Congressional Budget Office last week, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, came out with numbers that if there's not action on any of these things, then you're looking at the unemployment rate jumping from 7.9% to about 9.1%, and they do see a recession, kind of the economy tossed into recession. But a point of clarification, we all call these the Bush tax cuts, but in fact, in 2010, President Obama extended them for 2 years,
right,
under negotiations with Republicans, fair enough. But in some ways, they really are Obama's tax cuts, and they add to the deficit. And it's from a point of fairness, it's important to call these kind of a shared
yes
tax cut.
Let me make a point of clarification about that, okay? Obama agreed to extend those tax cuts at a time when the recovery was just getting underway. George Bush made those tax cuts at a different time in history, very significantly, and they led to a very poor economic recovery. So to call these the Obama tax cuts, I think, is simply a misnomer.
Well, I think it's a sense of fairness. It's a shared thing. I wholeheartedly agree that the context was coming out of a recovery. But you can argue we're facing that today, too.
Well, and to talk about these tax cuts, when you read articles about it, it's very rare to hear about or to see the total numbers. So the first decade of the Bush tax cuts, 2001 to 2010, $955 billion. The Obama extension, 2011 to 2012, $229 billion. The proposed extension, 2013 to 2021, $2 trillion for a grand total of $3 trillion. As a reporter, Kevin, how important is it to remind Americans just how much these tax cuts have cost?
Well, we've certainly, as our news organization has done that year after year after year, reminded people, because there's also a fiction out there that somehow this all exploded under Obama and was, you know, just fine until, you know, January 2009, and of course that's not the case. But it's important to remind of these numbers. I think when you get into the trillions, it's hard for people to get their heads around it. I think that's part of the difficulty in communicating this is just that it's such a big staggering number. But, you know, the groups like the Concord Coalition, Dave Walker, who had been the Comptroller General, has warned on this for well over 10 years. There have been people out there consistently warning that this is not sustainable and needs to be addressed, and the day of reckoning seems fairly near.
And so let's talk specifically about, let's put this in different pieces because it is so big. If you talk about the tax cuts, for example, there's a good piece in the Chronicle yesterday called Fiscal Cliff, What Would It Cost You? And as you mentioned, Jeff, this would hit everyone. The Tax Policy Center estimates that 90% of households would face a tax increase of about $3,600 next year. The top 1% would see their taxes rise by $120,000. If you're making between $40,000 and $65,000, you would pay about $2,000 more. So this would happen if nothing is done, right?
Yes, it would. It's not only the, forgive me, Kevin, for calling them the Bush tax cuts. It's not only the Bush tax cuts. It's, of course, the end of the payroll tax cut that President Obama put into effect to try and get the economy moving again in that very slow period, reducing our payroll taxes from 6.2% to 4.2% of our wages. There's a change, the alternative minimum tax, a problem that's too technical to bother with, but would raise a lot of money unfairly by keeping taxes up on a lot of people, even 100, 120 billion just next year alone, and a few other kinds of taxes. Of course, taxes will be going up for Obamacare, but that's a fairly small amount. So there are a number of different kinds of taxes that could go up.
Yeah, there are two big ones, too. The alternative minimum tax, which threatens about 30 million people, and that has to be dealt with before the end of the year. That and what's called Doc Fix, which is basically the Medicare program. Every year they put a patch so they don't have to cut benefits to doctors or raise taxes, so they're going to have to come up with money for both of those. So that's the more likely thing that's going to happen pretty quick this year is they're going to have to make those down payments on a grand bargain, and then this whole thing gets negotiated next year as part of a grand bargain. At least that's kind of the script it seems to be following so far.
And so, go ahead, Jeff.
Well, I think before people get too frightened, I would say it is not very likely that all these taxes are going to go up.
Yeah.
It could be that Brink will have some kind of brinksmanship played by Obama or by the Republicans, and we do go off of this fiscal cliff. People keep reminding us it's not a cliff so much as a slide, because not all of this literally happens on January 1st, but not too long after. So, but what's very likely to happen, I think, most people agree anyway, and maybe Kevin sees it differently, the payroll tax deduction will probably be eliminated. Payroll taxes will probably go up to 6.2%. The alternative minimum tax will probably be fixed. And the Bush tax increases will be maintained for everybody who makes under $250,000 a year. So the Obama administration would like to raise taxes on the well-off, and they do want that tax increase on probably for payroll. So they would be mitigating this or cutting the tax increase like something in half for most Americans, and more than for lower-income Americans or middle-income Americans than we're currently talking about, or than the numbers you posed, the numbers you presented, Rose.
And I think your listeners need to kind of look at the staging or the optics of what they're trying to do and what they actually do, because this town, of course, is famous for doing things that aren't what they appear. So if, let's say, at the end of the year, the Bush and Obama, we'll split it down the middle, the Bush-Obama tax cuts expire for everybody. All the president has to do is tell the IRS, we're going to maintain current withholding rates pending negotiations. So because the actual money next year actually goes to be paid the following year in taxes, they can maintain withholding rates so that it's not taking more out of your paycheck while they continue negotiations. So another possibility is that they go to the brink and over the cliff, so to speak, or the long slide, but they actually do things that signal, we're not going to actually let this happen. We're going to fix sometime in the next year, we'll have this grand bargain. And I think that's what they're going for. But it is striking how much each side has coming out of this and sticking to their guns, mm-hmm. as if we didn't just have an election.
Right. Well, and that's the other question I had is, who are the major players in this debate? And I definitely want to talk about the meetings the president is having today and tomorrow. But first off, he's going to have talks with top Democrats and Republicans on Friday. Kevin, you're in D.C. Can you name some names? Who are the major players who will be involved in these talks?
In the businesses? Or
No. I'm talking about politicians first.
Yeah, well, it's going to be the leadership for the most part. I mean, there's an interesting dynamic to all this that hasn't got a lot of attention. Traditionally, you've got two separate issues, budget and taxes. So
right.
You've got the committees of jurisdiction. On the House side, that would be Dave Camp, who runs the Ways and Means, which is the tax writing, and Max Baucus in the Senate, the Republican and the Democrat. On the budget side, that's Paul Ryan. And one of the interesting dynamics here is, now that he's emerged as somewhat of a national figure, does he want his fingerprints on this budget deal next year, or does he stay far away from it so that he can run against it in 4 years? So I think one of the dynamics is going to be, does he lead or does he follow? Does he let Ways and Means do most of this, or the Senate, which seems unlikely? Obviously, the leadership of Harry Reid, Mitch McConnell has done an op-ed basically saying, we're willing to be the loyal opposition. We understand there's been an election. At least they're saying that on paper. They also said this about health care, and we know how that kind of went down. So, I think most of this direction is going to come from the leadership. I think the Republicans have a harder time for the same reason that when Boehner and Obama negotiated before, and it came to nothing, it was in large measure because Boehner can't carry his own party in the House because of the Tea Party. And I think that's one of the interesting dynamics here is going to be the degree to which he has to maneuver within his own party. So it's pretty complex. It's one of those rare occasions where Democrats, and Jeff may disagree with me here, but where Democrats seem to be more united than Republicans, and that hasn't happened that much lately.
What about California Democrats? What role, say, for example, Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, Nancy Pelosi, what role are they playing in this?
Well, I think as senior members, they are going to play a big role in this. I suspect Dianne Feinstein has bigger matters on her plate right now with the Petraeus affair, but over time, a lot depends on you know, whether this is actually a real grand bargain, where everything, corporate taxes, territorial tax taxation, the whole big picture is on the table. That will that will determine a lot in terms of the California participation. And California, with the tech industry, with oil, California has a lot at stake in a big negotiation, and I think you're going to see they would obviously play a big role if we're going to get the grand bargain.
And that is Kevin Hall, national economics reporter for McClatchy Newspapers. He's in D.C. Jeff Madrick is a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books. He writes the Anti-Economist column for Harper's Magazine. You can find his latest piece, The Coming Fiscal Bluffs, Will President Obama Stand Tough in Budget Negotiations, on our website. And his latest book, Age of Greed, is now out in paperback. And we'd love to hear from you. You're going to hear nonstop about the fiscal cliff this week. President Obama is meeting with union and labor leaders today. They are saying hands off Social Security and Medicare. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes. Tomorrow, he's meeting with CEOs of companies like General Electric, Walmart, American Express, Procter & Gamble, IBM, Chevron, to talk about the tax issues here. And then on Friday, he'll be meeting with top Democrats and Republicans. So if you've got any questions about this so-called fiscal cliff, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about how taxes and the budget should be dealt with? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What message are you sending your representative on these crucial issues? Because remember, last time around, the president was willing to go to take cuts on TRICARE, Social Security, and Medicare. So what are your thoughts on this so-called fiscal cliff? You can leave a comment on our website or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And, Jeff, did you want to add anything else there just about who is making these final decisions?
Yeah. No, I defer to Kevin on the names in Washington. I'm as curious as you are about who's going to play there. I work out of New York City. So I think he's been a good summary. But there is a break in the ranks of economic advisors and, to some degree, Congress people on the Republican side about whether they would compromise on raising taxes for the rich. The issue becomes a little bit slightly technical. Should we raise tax rates? That is the rate you and I pay and David Koch pays on the next dollar he makes, the marginal income tax rate, or should we try to deal with raising taxes, in particular on well-off people, in other ways? Glenn Hubbard today, who is a Romney advisor, a conservative economist from Columbia University, argued in an FT column, the Financial Times column, that we should put put a top on certain kinds of deductions. In other words, you can only deduct so much of mortgage interest a year, or you can only make so many deductible charitable contributions a year. Now, I'd love to see the details there. That's what the whole Mitt Romney campaign was about. I'm going to do all this, but I'm not going to give you any details. So there is some kind of crack there. On the other hand, the question is what President Obama will be willing to give up in terms of cutting social programs. And
right.
You just mentioned he's already probably made a compromise. We get some reporting on the secret negotiations on Social Security and Medicare.
Right.
Will his concession to the Republicans be, okay, you give me higher taxes on the rich, and I'll give you concessions on cutting Social Security and Medicare? And that disturbs me a lot because it opens the door to an attack on the safety net in America, and it makes it sound like we really can't afford our entitlements programs. It's a Pete Peterson argument. We've heard a lot about Pete Peterson giving a lot of money to think tanks to argue that we've got to cut the deficit. It's our first priority, and that requires cutting Medicare and Social Security. I firmly believe it is does not more than marginally require those kinds of cuts, but we do have to do, and this is a longer discussion, is reform our health care system more aggressively. And Obamacare may be a start in that direction.
And just to be specific on what was agreed to in the summer of last year, the president agreed to increase Medicare premiums and later boost the eligibility age for the program from 65 to 67. He was also willing to reduce Social Security payments by using a less generous formula for making cost of living increases. Kevin, can you tell us anything else about what was agreed to last year?
I think those were the big points, but I think going forward, too, you're looking at Social Security. There was the Bush-Cheney era was marked by the trying to have private accounts, and it was very fast and loose with the numbers, and Social Security is going to go broke and yada, yada. And, in fact, it's not. And in a worst-case scenario, if nothing happened, people would get 75% of what they were going to get, which is not broke. It's less than what you'd get. But obviously,
well,
people aren't going to let it get that
way. Kevin.
Yeah. And but beyond that, I think Social Security is eminently fixable. You can raise right now that's capped. I forget off the top of my head. It had been 109. I think it's somewhere around 113.
110,000, yeah.
Yeah. So it's capped at how much of your income is subject to that. And you could just make all of it, which is unlikely, which would be a way to tax the rich. Significantly, Obama did not use the word tax rates when he spoke after the election. He used the word revenues. And I think that's, where this game is. Nobody's really wanting to show their cards yet. They're all talking about, the fact that he's not talking rates, that gives Republicans the cover to agree to higher taxes without raising the tax rate. And so I think that's a lot of the game. But going back to your question on Social Security, we've raised the retirement age. There's been some talk, I think, in the Bowles-Simpson report, they had the idea of indexing the retirement age to longevity. Well, that's that's one way to draw that out too. So I mean, there are fixes to that. Medicare is a tougher problem, and it's a temporary problem. And I think this is one that people also lose sight at. We have 75, 76 million Americans, baby boomers, born between 46 and 64, cycling through the Medicare system. That's a big strain. It's not going to be repeated, but it's a 15-year window, roughly, through which you're going to have a lot of stress on it. And you also longevity is a big issue to this. When the program was established, nobody thought people would be living 20 years longer than we're now living 20 years longer than we were roughly than we were before. So I think the funding mechanism has to be addressed, but it's not the end of the world. The world will not come crashing down if people pay 2 percentage points more.
Well, we've got a number of calls, but we have to take a quick break. And after the break, we'll take calls about how this will affect military spending. This is another good question. Why is no one talking about anyone below the middle class and how this would affect them? And we'll touch on that after the break. We'll also talk about the meetings that the president is having today and tomorrow. We're speaking with Kevin Hall, with McClatchy, and Jeff Madrick, regular contributor to the New York Review of Books. We are talking about this so-called fiscal cliff, which really focuses on the future of taxes and budget cuts and Social Security and Medicare. How is President Obama going to deal with this? He was willing to really give up a lot last year. Will he do the same this time around? We've got full lines. We'll take calls right after break. You can also post a comment to yourcallradio.org. You can also send an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. What questions do you have about this so-called fiscal cliff? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
Every Tuesday, the Your Call team sends out the weekly email newsletter and help you keep up on what's coming up on the show. It also gives resources to let you learn more and get involved. Subscribe today so you'll know what's coming up and can submit your questions and comments before the show goes to air. It's free and easy to sign up. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org.
My name's Kerry Davis.
My name's Ken Hopper.
We're ironworkers on the Golden Gate Bridge.
Mi nombre es Judith Camacho. Estamos en San Francisco.
My name is Mitchell Allen, and I'll be interviewing my mom.
Who do you want to hear from? I'm Dave Isay, founder of StoryCorps. We're recording stories from the Bay Area and archiving them at the Library of Congress. Share yours at our recording booth at the Contemporary Jewish Museum in San Francisco. Call 1-800-850-4406 or visit StoryCorps.org to make a reservation.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Hana Baba will be filling in for Holly Kernan, and she'll be talking about what school discipline should look like. Every year, 400,000 students in California are suspended, 18,000 are expelled, but there are new methods of discipline avoiding both of those, including one in Oakland called restorative justice. So what really works here, and what is the overall goal? What do you think discipline should look like? And on Thursday, we will talk about what's happening in Sacramento. It appears that Democrats now have a supermajority in California. So what does this mean? Will it produce big change? Will it happen right away? And now that the Democrats do control Sacramento, what do you want them to focus on? That's Thursday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about what you are going to be hearing about for the next couple of weeks, fiscal cliff, fiscal cliff. And that is it's a combination of what happens with the tax cuts and what happens with spending cuts. We are also going to spend some time, and we already have, talking about Social Security and Medicare. And we've got full lines, so we'll take a number of calls in a row, and then we'll get responses from Kevin Hall with McClatchy and Jeff Madrick, regular contributor to the New York Review of Books. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from George in San Francisco. Hi, George.
Thank you, Rose, and thank you and your crew for maintaining an energetic level of criticism and inquiry week in and week on.
Well, thank you.
We're encouraged to hear this discussion and hoping that in this portion of the program we could address the question of military spending, because if we recall correctly, and maybe we were dreaming and we were listening to some other channel, there was a big chunk of change in military expenditures that was up for reductions. It wasn't going to be called a peace dividend this time, but it was going to be an automatic reduction. And maybe, as your guest wisely said, it's not a fiscal cliff. Maybe it's a gradient of some kind. But is there an opportunity here to start to convert that military budget into something else?
Well, Kevin, can you give us an update on the military spending?
Well, he hit the nail on the head on one thing, your caller, and that's that if it's going to something else, it's not going to deficit reduction. And one of the things that came up a lot during the debate over drawing down Iraq and Afghanistan and the cost, the war costs, is that, you know, it will allow us to spend on other things. Well, remember, we borrowed money from the Chinese and others to pay for these wars. So using that money for something else is not really going to get us out of the doghouse. That money needs to go away. We need to shrink the size of spending and do it over a period of time that's long enough that it doesn't have an economic drag on the economy. There's going to be some economic drag, which then gets offset also to some degree with new activities. But in terms of opportunity, you know, if you reduce spending, you know, history has shown that the military spending, I mean, it was a Republican Eisenhower who coined the term, if I'm not mistaken, a military-industrial complex.
Right.
And there's a lot of jobs tied to military, particularly around the Beltway. And people tend to do everything they can to not lose their jobs. So I think you're going to see a lot of focus on maintaining that spending, and then there's the perennial fight in Congress over which bases get closed and which get drawn down. But I think the way to think of it, as for your listeners, is that this isn't money that can be spent somewhere else. It's money that wasn't in the bank to begin with. Mm-hmm. It was borrowed money, and we should think of it that way.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, and the Center go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, I think, but, you know, there was good news that there was going to be an audit. There is indeed going to be, and it will be compromised away, but there was going to be an equal cut between social programs and military spending, and Social Security and Medicare were excluded from the social programs in the cutting when they made this bargain some time ago. I think it was August of 2011, my memory may be slipping. The super committee was supposed to come up with a deal to cut, what was it, nearly $1 trillion in government spending over 10 years, mm-hmm. and they couldn't. So there was going to be an automatic cut in military, an automatic cut in other social spending. Would have been harsh and cruel, but Medicare and Social Security were going to be separated from that. Now, we probably won't get as big a cut in military because of some of the reasons Kevin mentioned, the most important of which is there's defense spending in every congressional district in America, and congressmen don't want to lose it. It was a brilliant plan on the part of defense contractors and the Pentagon to do it that way. Yeah. But if we can cut military spending less, we will have to cut other kinds of spending more, and I think when they do make a bargain, it will be Social Security and Medicare. Right. That's what's going to happen, and it won't be as much military spending. I'd love to see us.
And the first who warned about the fiscal cliff were, you know, Lockheed and some of the big military contractors were the first to really get active and say they were already slowing down their hiring. They were, you know, they were reassessing their employment needs, and you know, they're basically threatening in a non-threatening way, threatening and raising the issue of the fiscal cliff, you know, probably 4 months ago.
And they gave money to both Obama and Romney. Yeah. And according to the Center for Public Integrity, 50 program areas at the Pentagon would take a roughly $500 billion hit, which they say seems like a lot, but would actually be less than 10% of the $5.8 trillion with a T, that the Obama administration wants the Pentagon to spend from 2013 to 2021. So, Kevin, how does this look in D.C., where you've got the military spending, you've got the taxes, you've got the budget, Social Security and Medicare? I mean, they've got 7 weeks to reach an agreement here.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to reach an agreement, and I think there's kind of a universal view that they're not going to. If Boehner has said repeatedly, you know, what they're after is a down payment on an agreement. So I think that's to watch for. What can be nailed down now? It's got to be something enough that doesn't prompt another downgrade by the ratings agencies, and enough is credible enough. But as we saw with the budget deal, with these deep cuts that are supposed to take place, you know, we're going to put that off again. And then why, if you're the ratings agencies, why are you convinced that next year is going to be different than this year, and that they're going to make these tough choices that, you know, President Bush had the BROMAC Commission and President Obama had the Bull Simpson. And you know, I'm not quite sure what we're doing at these White House meetings. We know what the problem is. We know what needs to be done. Mm-hmm. You know, there are winners and losers, and that's the problem. And who comes out ahead?
So then on military spending, you don't think anything will take place? Anything will happen?
No, I think there will be cuts, but the question is how deep they go. And one of the things that I think you've probably had him on your show before, Joe Stiglitz.
Yes.
He had warned years ago when it was supposed to be the $1 trillion war, then it became the $3 trillion war. And he's done yeoman's work in terms of publicizing the true war costs that are never budgeted. And one of the things he had called for was a lockbox for veterans. And, you know, a lot of the veterans, the spending on veterans' health care and stuff of that is discretionary spending. So if you're going to cut across the board discretionary spending, think about the out years. You know, not everybody, this is fresh in everybody's mind right now. But 10 years from now, are they really going to be standing up for veterans the way they are today? And the history of the Vietnam era, the answer is no. And it's just, I find it sad that, you know, He called. He had a very rational argument. Let's have a lockbox so when we start cutting defense spending that we know that veterans aren't going to suffer for that. And they ignored him.
Hmm. Rose, can I make a very important point?
Yes.
Stiglitz's name reminds me of that. I also would like to point out to people I run something called the Rediscovering Government Initiative at the Roosevelt Institute. And Stiglitz and I are both senior fellows at the Roosevelt Institute as well. We don't have to be dealing with the deficit next year. You know, there's an elephant in the room here. This idea that suddenly we've got to cut our deficit next year, or we're going to go the way of Greece, as I think Mitt Romney liked to say. That's just nonsense. Mm. We actually need a bigger deficit next year, and we had better talk about this in this program, because even if we come to a compromise, and I think Kevin is right, they're going to postpone the big issues. But even if we come to a compromise, there's going to be a dampening effect on an economy that's already weak. The fiscal cliff would take, let's say, about 4% of buying power out of the economy. The best deal we're going to get would still take 2% buying power out of the economy. We do not. There's a deficit mania, I think Joe likes to call it a deficit, something like that, deficit hysteria. Much of it. Propaganda, in my view, and I know that's a strong word, but I think it's right, from think tanks that argue that it's the highest priority we face. And you know, the ratings agencies really aren't worried about our debt. They're worried about that Republican showdown. Remember when that occurred, when they wouldn't raise the debt limit? Mm-hmm. That was a strategy, in my view, a hysterical strategy on the part of the Republicans to shut down government and not pay our debt. That's what the rating agencies are worried about. They're not worried about our deficit per se. Yeah. Now, down the road, we do have to worry about the deficit. That is almost entirely due to the rapid rise in health care costs. The aging population will affect Medicare and Medicaid. But the bigger issue is how fast health care costs rise. The projections by the government of rapid rises in health care, which is basically an extrapolation of how rapidly health care costs have been rising in the preceding 5 or 10 years. I forget how they do it. Basically, it's somewhat informal. If that keeps up, that's what will drive deficits. And then interest on paying off the deficits drives future problems. But we are really living in a world which is created in a nation that has adopted austerity economics to some degree like the Europeans have. And Europe is now in an unnecessary recession because in particular of the austerity mania of the Germans. And to some degree, not nearly as much, thank goodness, but to some degree, we're following the same mythology. Austerity is a myth, and arguably the most dangerous economic idea in the world, the most dangerous economic idea since it was last practiced in the early 1930s during the Great Depression.
And so, Jeff, what do you think this is really about? Because we're getting a ton of emails about Social Security and Medicare, and the economist James Galbraith had a piece in Salon in which he says that the debt and the deficit crisis is fake. Even the most dim member of Congress must know this. He says big money has been gunning for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid since the beginning of Social Security in 1935. The motives are partly financial. As one scholar once put it to me, the payroll tax is the Mississippi of cash flows. Anything that diverts part of it into private funds and insurance premiums is a meal ticket for the elite of the predator state. So how much of this is really about privatizing Social Security and Medicare?
Well, I think a fair amount of it. I mean, Galbraith and I have been friends for years. I think to some degree he overstates the case. There will be a deficit problem down the road at some point, but essentially he's got it correct. Awful lot of money can be made by Wall Street by privatizing Social Security. That is letting Wall Street run your money. They've done a very bad job of it. The 401ks, the people who depend on 401ks and Wall Street money management are in deep trouble because they're not going to get adequate private pension coverage to supplement Social Security coverage when they retire. We already have the clear-cut example of that. That's why they wanted 401ks so badly. So I'm very worried about any movement towards privatizing Social Security, and I sure hope if Obama does anything on the social side, it will be to stem that. The problem is once you start doing serious compromises on Social Security, and that cost of living adjustment is a serious compromise, once you start making serious compromises, it may not stop because the public begins to believe you really have to do that. As Kevin pointed out, there are some pretty easy fixes for Social Security. And Rose, can I just say one other thing quickly about Medicare? The idea of raising the eligibility age of Medicare from 65 to 67 is outright cruel. Imagine you are retired. You're 66 years old, and now you have to buy a private insurance plan. You know how much that's going to cost you? And you know what's going to happen? It's triage. The 66 and 67-year-olds will not, and 65 and 66-year-olds will simply not have health care coverage in a period in their lives when they may need it very badly. It is a very cruel idea, and it's very upsetting that Obama apparently agreed to that with Boehner some time ago.
Or they simply file for disability claims, and you've seen that number explode in this crisis over the last several years.
That is Kevin Hall, national economics reporter with McClatchy, and Jeff Madrick is a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books. He writes the Anti-Economist column for Harper's. We've got a number of callers on the line who've been waiting patiently, so let's go through a number of them, and then we'll get responses. Let's go to Evelyn in Oakland. Hi, Evelyn.
Thank you. You have the best guests in program. This is Thanksgiving month. I'm so grateful for you.
Thank you. The question
I have is, I am one of these people that was dropped from the middle class when I started retirement to the lowest poverty because of inflation and other sales tax and so forth. So, from my view, I was disappointed when Clinton turned and said, not people first, but it's the economy, stupid. And it seems like this cliff is just another day after the election disavowing all of the people of the United States, and because we never heard him say anything about the lower class, the retired, poor, what can we do? It seems like this is just another tweak of the Reagan, Cheney, Bush, tea towel of trickle-down.
Well, that's the question we will definitely get to before we end. What can we do? Thank you for calling in, Evelyn. And we will also talk about how this will affect people like yourself who are dipping below the middle class. Let's go next, though, to Mark in Oakland. Hi, Mark.
Thanks. And I'm sorry if my line isn't that good. It's a numbers game. And I don't think we can tax the top 400 families in the nation enough to create the revenue. But nobody wants to talk about the financial transaction tax that needs to be used on Wall Street. Billions and billions of transactions happen there with no fee. And that's going to generate money. Another thing that's not talked about is our entire culture. We have a culture that doesn't want to help people stay healthy. We have a culture that creates people that are going to be sick at the end of their lives. It's like you never take your car in for maintenance until you have 250,000 miles on it. Of course, you have all these problems. These aren't ever going to be addressed. So these little games that we talk about, raising this, cutting that, we need to talk about the real issues. Thanks.
Well, thank you. We actually are going to do a show about the financial transaction tax. We'll be joined by the National Nurses United in the coming weeks because they have been doing actions. In fact, there have been arrests just in the last couple of days in New York and I believe in Michigan, where a number of citizens are calling for a financial transaction tax, the Robin Hood tax. So thank you. And we'll get a response in just a few minutes. Let's go first to Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann.
Hi there. This is something I actually should know the answer to, but I don't. What will the impact be on whatever the administration does on Social Security and Medicare on folks with disabilities who already have both? Is that akin to being 65 or over before? I just don't know how it is going to work. And then as an aside, my personal opinion is that if we were to go the route of instituting single payer for all, that would solve the deficit problem in a heartbeat.
Well, thank you, Ruth Ann. Good point, good question. We'll get to it in just a minute. Let's go next to Andy in Redwood City. Hi, Andy. Hello, Andy.
Hi, Rose.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Hey, my comment is Franklin Delano Roosevelt, when he negotiated with the Republicans in 1941, he started at 100% marginal tax rate on the top tax bracket. That's what Mr. Obama should do. Should tell them 100%. Then it was on after the first 200,000 made. Today's inflation, we make it up to 3 million to be consistent. But that's how he should start the negotiations. Then let the Republicans get them down to 94% or something like that. But the rich people, the top tax bracket, have got to start paying. They've been taking too much, and they're putting the working class in misery in this country, and it's time for them to pay up like they do in France. It's a 70% top marginal tax bracket, 75, I believe. That's what we need here. We're way down as far as the top tax bracket. 35% is way, way too low. Pete Peterson has got to pay up. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you brought up those tax rates because this conversation with the fiscal cliff and the taxes, you're rarely hearing about tax rates. So thank you so much. And let's hear next from Alex in San Francisco. Hi, Alex.
Yes. Whatever they do, I think they should not do any legislation that goes retroactively. because people plan their lives, like buy homes, assuming they have deductions on mortgage, the interest. So whatever, and benefit cuts. I mean, people plan their careers and everything based on existing laws. Any change to this system should be looking forward, not backward.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the call. And we've got a number of emails from a number of listeners who are very angry about Social Security and Medicare. Sheila says, we are going to take to the streets to defend Social Security, which has never cost this nation one cent. I've already called Boxer Feinstein and Barbara Lee's office demanding that they stand up for the 99%. So why don't we go over some of these calls? What are your thoughts, Jeff or Kevin, whoever wants to take this, about how this will affect people who are, you know, poor, living below middle class, and also people with disabilities?
Well, there's one way to do it that hasn't been talked about. If the Bush-Obama era, we'll call them Bush-era tax cuts, if they are allowed to expire, then you go back to Clinton-era tax rates in which the poor actually would be subject to taxes. I don't think that's going to happen, but if you were just simply to let all things stay as law requires, that they get sunsetted out of existence and they go back to then the poor would be most affected. On Social Security, I don't think either party really wants to mess with that. I think they saw under Bush the consequences of even tinkering with that. I don't think many politicians really. There may be a couple of people who have this really safe seats, but who might advocate that. But I don't think any of the leadership thinks that that's a winner.
Jeff?
I don't think anybody's going to mess with disability insurance.
No.
I'm not convinced they won't do something on Social Security, so I hope Kevin is right. I think, you know, we don't create good jobs in America. We're talking about, you know, Medicare and Social Security and so forth. Medicaid, as it is inadequate. Obamacare was very good for poor people. It expanded Medicaid coverage. The numbers skip me. My mind for the moment. I've written about this often, but many millions of people poor people will qualify for Medicaid. It used to be a plan only for families until Obamacare. Now it's for poor individuals, and the eligibility rate has moved to a higher level of the poverty rate. But we need a higher minimum wage. We need some serious infrastructure spending that might give employment to at least the so-called working class, the just below middle income class. I do think we have to pay much more attention to poverty issues. Poverty actually went up in this recovery. The big reason, I think, is we've created so many bad jobs. We at least need a minimum wage that provides a poverty level of existence for people, and in many cases, minimum wage is inadequate. So we really do. I'm glad you bring up the poverty issue, because there's too much talk about the dark middle class, frankly. The middle class does have a very hard time, but we really have to talk about the poor and helping the poor and helping the poor rise in this this country.
Well, and I often repeat this fact that's hardly ever mentioned. The majority of the new jobs that are being created right now pay between $7.50 and $13.50 an hour. Which is obviously very hard. It's hard to make ends meet on that. And also, what about this important question about what we can do? Jeff, what are your thoughts? What steps can people take to actually get involved in this? Again, the president is meeting today, as we speak probably, with members of labor and unions. And I just want to mention a couple of these names. You've got Rich Trumka, AFL-CIO, John Podesta, Center for American Progress, Justin Rubin with Move On, Mary Kay Henry with SEIU. And then tomorrow he'll be meeting with Mike Duke, president of Walmart, David Coate with Honeywell, Aetna, Xerox, American Express, all the Fortune 500, IBM, Chevron, Ford, Pepsi. What can the people do to have a voice in this?
Well, the people should be, you know, I don't want to foment anything here, but the people should go into the streets, or they should write countless letters to their Congress people to talk about how Social Security and Medicare have to be preserved. There is a mythology in America, supported mostly by corporate America, but also by the media, except McClatchy, that we have a serious deficit problem and we cannot afford our entitlements programs. Now, those entitlements programs, like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, they need reforms of some kind and efficiencies. but we can afford them. We pay the lowest tax rates of any OECD country in the world except one or two. The lowest. We pay 10 percentage points. That's total taxes, federal, state, and local, below the average OECD country. And we get teary-eyed about how high our tax rates are and how they have to be cut. If we raise those taxes just 3 or 4 percentage points, there is no percentage points of GDP. There is no entitlements crisis or deficit crisis.
Yeah, and somehow or another, we've become convinced that if we go 4 percentage points up on our income tax rates or our brackets, that somehow that's akin to going back to the 70% rate of Eisenhower. I mean, it's simply nonsense. It is basic math that our Medicare is unsustainable at current levels. That doesn't mean you throw it out. There are ways to fix it, you know, without changing the core and the tendency. And I think that's the challenge, is kind of getting past the rhetoric. But I do think, the deficit is an issue. We can be Greece if we don't show any credibility in addressing our problems. That's the only place where Greece does, where it's a fitting analogy. And if you go back and look at what S&P, I'd urge your listeners to go back and look at S&P's criticism when they downgraded the U.S. debt rating or credit rating. And, they were spot on. Look at today, and everything they said was spot on.
But they are worried about a debt ceiling. This is self-imposed. And, Kevin, I actually seriously have to disagree with you. We are nowhere near Greece.
Oh, I'm not saying we are.
We have a thriving economy. We basically pay taxes. We actually even have strong export markets. It is not remotely comparable.
No, what's comparable is if the rates go up.
Using those analogies is quite damaging.
The analogy fits. If a country is unwilling to address its problems and says year after year, I'm going to do it this way, and then doesn't do it, it loses credibility with markets, and the borrowing costs go up. Our debt then gets more expensive to service.
Let me just say one last thing.
And I'm sorry, I've got to cut you off there because we're out of time. We will definitely continue this conversation. Jeff Madrick, regular contributor to the New York Review of Books. Kevin Hall, national economics reporter with McClatchy. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. And here's what's coming up tomorrow. What should school discipline look like? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about how schools are dealing with discipline. Every year, 400,000 students in California are suspended and another 18,000 are expelled. But new methods of discipline avoid suspension and expulsion, including one Oakland program called Restorative Justice. If you're a teacher, student, or parent, what is your experience of school discipline? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What really works and what is the overall goal? It's Your Call with Hanaa Baba and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihei Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.